Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Many years ago, Riley Knight completed a degree in history. This proved to be a bad move, as it was absolutely useless for him. Until now, here's some half-assed history.
What's going on, mate? Great to have you along for some more half-assed history. This week on the agenda, we're having a chat about Owain Glyndwr, a Welsh noble who, in the 15th century, led a rebellion against the English. And even today, Glyndwr is remembered as a national hero in Wales, as someone who took the fight to the treacherous and tyrannical English and their rule over the Welsh people. And his story is a very interesting one, particularly when talking about the great successes his revolt had, initially at least. We haven't gotten across a huge amount of Welsh history on the show so far. We did spend a couple of shows talking about the famous Welsh pirate Black Bart, episodes 195, 196, get across them. But apart from that, I'm sorry to say, there hasn't been much Welsh history showcased on Half-Assed History. So we're here to change that this week with the story of one of the most famous Welsh people in history. We'll have to come back to other famous Welsh people another time. So keep an eye out for episodes on... Shirley Bassey, I guess, or Catherine Zeta-Jones. Wait, hang on. Anthony Hopkins is Welsh as well? Bloody hell. The Welsh are like bloody Canadians. They're hidden everywhere. Anyway, a bit more seriously, I do want to offer premature apologies to any Welsh listeners here for my pronunciation of certain Welsh words today. I have done my best. I've looked up the pronunciations. I've had a practice. I've really tried to get them, but... Hoo boy, the Welsh language really doesn't make it easy. There's lots of hissing and lisping and a real lack of vowels. Welsh Wheel of Fortune must be very cheap for the contestants, I tell you what. But no, look, finally, before we begin, thanks go to alert listeners David Culliford, Andrew Edwards, Angus Rees, and the steadfast Moggets Ebel, all for suggesting Owain Glyndwr for an episode and more broadly wanting a bit of Welsh history. So... thanks very much to the lot of you, but let's get stuck in here. Let's get into it. Let's get across the story of the great Welsh hero, Owain Glyndwr, and tell the tale of the brave Welsh revolt that he led off. We're going all the way back to the year 1354, to the northeast of Wales, near its border with England, because it was there, in that year, that young Owain Glyndwr was born into a noble family, a social class in Wales known as Uchelwyr, Welsh nobles from before the English conquest of Wales that had still stuck around and held onto their lands and titles. And the Uchelwyr are distinct from the nobles in Wales who were of English heritage, there are a lot of them there as well, put in place there to rule by the English after their various conquests. Now, Uchelwyr generally spoke English as well as Welsh. The broad population of Wales still spoke Welsh, in the 14th century. But the Uchelwyr not only spoke Welsh alongside English, they also maintained Welsh customs and traditions. And despite this... Still held a good amount of political power and prestige in a political system dominated by English feudal lords. Anyway, Glyndwr, he was born into this family of Uchelwyr, and he inherited a very bloody impressive pedigree from both sides of his family, let me tell you. His old man was a bloke named Gruffydd Feichan II. He was a reasonably powerful lord with royal blood dating back to his princely ancestors of a century or so previous. While on his mum's side, his mum was a woman named Ellen Faust Thomas Ap Llewellyn, She counted amongst her ancestors King Edward Longshanks and Queen Eleanor of Castile, as well as countless kings and princes from Welsh history as well. So this young kid's blood is as blue as the Carlton Football Club, mate. This kid is as royal as a flush. But even so, he was just a Welsh noble. He was just the scion of the Uchelwyr. Nothing hugely notable about him as a youngster. Although his career of choice sets him apart a little bit from other young medieval nobles of the time, because rather than get into horsemanship and swordplay and carousing and hunting and all that sort of thing, young Glyndŵr instead became a lawyer of all things. He was fostered by notable English legal figures of the time, and then as a young man went away to London to work as a legal apprentice and stayed there for several years, for 7 or so years. By 1384, however, he was back in Wales. He was married to a woman named Margaret Hanmer, the son of a prominent Anglo-Welsh judge, Sir David Hanmer, possibly one of the people that Glyndŵr was fostered with. And together they had a lot of kids. His wife, that is, not him and David. Margaret and Glyndŵr had at least 8 children. There may have been more, although I will say that Glyndŵr did play away a little bit. He had at least 4 more kids outside of wedlock, the absolute cad. But his career as a lawyer was actually cut short. It didn't last all that long because in 1384, he did end up getting into military affairs. He joined up to serve in the English army. And in the 3 or 4 years that he spent working as a soldier, he managed to cram a lot into this time. He was first deployed to the English border with Scotland, where he fought for the English on behalf of King Richard II against the Scots, before later fighting all the way to the south of England at sea when the English defeated a fleet made up of French, Spanish, and Flemish allies. And then, really interestingly, in 1387, he served as a squire to none other than Henry Bolingbroke, the future King Henry IV of England, with whom Glyndŵr would have a very different relationship in the fullness of time. These blokes were very closely associated, historically speaking, and it's very interesting that he started off as Henry's squire before becoming, well, one of the king's greatest enemies, as we'll talk about. But this was later on. This was after Henry Bolingbroke became king. He was eventually crowned the king of England, King Henry IV. After he overthrew Richard II down the track in 1399, but we'll get to that. But in 1388, after a couple of years as a soldier, Glyndŵr, he'd been all over the place. He'd rubbed shoulders with the rich and famous, but then, as internal crises began to consume England from within, his role in English affairs, and I guess just in the realm of historical notability, really took a bit of a backseat there for a couple of years. He wasn't very involved in the unfolding crises that I just mentioned in England. We're not going to spend too long talking about these crises. I'll give you a quick rundown here. The long and the short of it is that a bunch of powerful English lords rebelled against Richard II, including Henry Bolingbroke. Henry himself was eventually exiled, and then when Richard blocked him from inheriting his father's lands and titles, Henry gathered supporters in open rebellion of the English king, overthrew and imprisoned Richard, starved him to death, and claimed the English throne for himself. Now, interestingly, I was reminded of this while writing this particular part of the episode. This is the second time that we've quickly glossed over this particular chapter of English history. We spent about the same amount of time and went into about the same amount of detail talking about Henry IV taking the English throne in episode 223, The Hundred Years' War, Get Across It. In that episode, however, Owen Glyndŵr got about 2.5 sentences, while in this one, he's going to get the entire bloody thing, mate, as the Welsh Revolt kicks off. But before that, in the time between his military service through the back half of the 1380s and the rebellion that he ultimately kicked off in 1400, in other words, I guess just the period known as the 1390s, Glyndŵr, he didn't get up to all that much. He just chilled in Wales. He held his little court and his little estates. He welcomed visitors. He took it easy and generally just had a good time. That is, until the English got back on their usual nonsense of oppressing the Welsh in the late 1390s, which would ultimately prompt Glyndŵr to rise in rebellion. The English have never really treated the Welsh particularly courteously. Unlike Scotland and Northern Ireland, Wales isn't even represented on the British Union flag. And at the turn of the 15th century, things were no different. The conflict between Richard and Henry had taken its toll on Wales. Richard had many Welsh supporters, some of whom were quite reluctant to support the usurping Henry. And so as a result of this, in order to consolidate his position as the new king, Henry cracked down on these Welsh nobles that still, he thought, were harbouring sympathies for his predecessor Richard. Glyndwr, who, as I mentioned, largely kept himself to himself at this point, was dragged into this ongoing political drama, despite not really having any huge vestige of alliance left for the vanquished King Richard. He was instead dragged in by a neighbouring baron in 1399. This baron, Baron Grey of Ruthen, he opportunistically annexed some of Glyndwr's territory. And so Glyndwr, he went to the English Parliament to try to get him to, you know, knock it off and get his land back from Baron Grey. The English Parliament did something that they still very proudly do to this day, all the way in the 21st century, and simply ignored the Welshman that had come to complain to them. And so Glyndwr lost that round to Grey. But it only got worse from there, because the next year in 1400, Grey didn't inform Glyndwr of his feudal duty to provide troops for the English army to defend the Scottish border, and as a result, Glyndwr didn't provide these troops, and Grey was able to go around talking about Glyndwr's failure to provide these feudal levies, spreading rumours that he was a traitor to the English crown. Now, Grey had a lot more political clout at Henry's court in London than Glyndwr did, and so Glyndwr's protests about his name being slandered in this way, they fell on deaf ears. He petitioned Parliament, he petitioned the courts, he even petitioned King Henry IV, but it all came to nothing. Obviously, Baron Grey was just trying to sideline or eliminate a local political rival. There is no way he could have foreseen the consequences of his decision to go after Glyndwr like this. Because Glyndwr, sick and tired of being pushed around by the English, ignored, branded a traitor, he decided, well, enough's enough. Bugger this for a joke. If they're going to call me a traitor, I might as well be. He decided it was time for the Welsh to seize control of their destiny. And so, on the 16th of September 1400, Glyndwr, with an honestly pretty small group of loyal supporters, used this royal heritage that I spoke about earlier, his blue blood, to proclaim himself the Prince of Wales, no longer under the authority of the English king. This open act of rebellious defiance meant that the Welsh revolt had begun. And while it started small with scattered followers across northeast Wales, this rebellion would grow to encompass the entire nation of Wales and last a decade and a half. Knowing they were outmatched by Henry and his English forces, however, Glyndwr and his rebels had to be very careful in how they approached the opening stages of this conflict. Now, time was on their side. They had that going for them. Their smaller forces were able to launch attacks and raids on English interests in the region very, very quickly before Henry could respond. And so, the first person that Glyndwr went after was, of course, Baron Grey, attacking Ruthen Castle and bringing many of the towns and villages in the area over to his side. One bad turn deserves another, and Glyndwr was able to settle that score very quickly in going after his neighbouring rival. But from there, he spread out. He invited other Welsh settlements to join his cause. Those that did swelled his numbers, and those that didn't were sacked and burnt to the ground. But for the most part, particularly in northern Wales, hordes of people, farmers, labourers, workers of all kinds, they laid down their tools and took up arms in support of Glyndwr and his rebellion. News travelled very quickly, and those sympathetic to Glyndwr's cause all the way down in South Wales, that's old South Wales rather than New South Wales, also rose in rebellion against Henry. And honestly, the people in southern Wales didn't need much of an excuse. It was probably for them less about supporting Glyndwr and more about absolutely bloody hating Henry. You remember before I mentioned there were a lot of noble Welsh families that had supported Richard II. A lot of them were concentrated in the south of Wales. And these southern Welsh families joined the rebellion more or less to get one over on Henry. Although I will say some of them did swear allegiance to Glyndwr personally. And all of them gave the English the business throughout southern Wales. So whatever the case, whatever the reason they were there, their hats were well and truly in the ring. But in the meantime, you may be wondering, what is Henry doing about all this? Well, as I said, time was well and truly on the side of the Welsh, because Henry was busy fighting, can you guess? No, not the Welsh. And also, no, not the French, although that's a good guess. No, he was fighting, your third and final guess? Yes, of course, the Scots. But he responded very quickly. He disengaged from the fight that was ongoing with the Scottish up north. And in just over a week after Glyndŵr's rebellion had begun, Henry had arrived at the border between England and Wales, ready to make these blasted Welshmen taste English steel. Except it seems that the Welsh didn't have much of an appetite, because they made a complete fool of the English king, especially with their home ground advantage. As Henry marched into Wales, Glyndŵr's forces withdrew into the wilderness, and rather than fight any pitched battles, they fought using guerrilla tactics. They raided and harassed the English as the English went marching about, attempting to find an opportunity to, you know, properly contest the Welsh, an opportunity that was never forthcoming. The weather was, I mean, it goes without saying, right? It's Wales in September and October. What do you expect it's going to be? It was absolutely terrible. It was all wet and miserable. And soon the English army, too, were just as wet and just as miserable. Henry did his best, but his army, tired after its march down from Scotland, unable to force any kind of battle and under constant hit-and-run attacks from Welsh guerrillas, they were in a hopeless position. Eventually, Henry tried a new tactic. Down in the south of Wales, he just started to burn villages to the ground. But this backfired spectacularly when he fell victim to a devastating ambush at the hand of Glyndŵr's southern allies. The English ended up having to flee altogether. They ran from Wales with their tails between their legs. Henry arrived back in England in mid-October with nothing to show for weeks of campaigning across Wales. So, the first round went to Glyndŵr, and you can imagine what this did for the momentum and the morale of those following him, and more broadly, for the image of his rebellion. It had the effect, as you've probably guessed, of causing more and more people to flock to his side. The successes that they'd had so far only inspired more supporters to come and take up the cause. Most of northern and central Wales, fed up with English rule, joined the growing rebellion, and into 1401, Glyndŵr had an enormous force of followers at his back, all in ferocious support of the new Prince of Wales. And this was a disaster for the English, because their position was already incredibly, incredibly tenuous. Henry has barely had his ass on the throne for, you know, a handful of years. He does not have a strong, consolidated position as a new English king. He's got the Scots to worry about up north. He's got mutinous barons of his own back on home turf, back in England. And so he realizes he might be in deep poop here. He gathered what forces he could, and he sent them into Wales to try to crush Glyndŵr and this rebellion before it got even more out of hand. But I will say this, it wasn't all just military bluster and soldiers marching to war. King Henry also put forth a carrot as well as a stick, because he offered an amnesty for all the rebels so far, except obviously for Glyndŵr and his closest supporters. They weren't getting away with this, but other Welsh nobles were invited to accept a royal pardon, pay a fine for their misdeeds, and be welcomed back into the fold of English loyalty. Now, some took this amnesty, but most didn't. Instead, the rebels decided it was time to attack and take the fight to the English like never before. And as such, they decided to attack and capture Conwy Castle up on the northern coast of Wales. Now, at first blush, this sounds like a pretty bloody silly thing to do. Anyone who has listened to episode 158, The History of the Castle Girt Across, it will know that capturing a defended castle is an extremely difficult thing to achieve. However, it only took 40 Welsh rebels, if you'll believe it, to seize this castle, because they took it with cunning rather than with force of arms. The Welsh rebels waited until Good Friday, which fell on the 1st of April in 1401, when all but five of the small English garrison defending the castle was at a church service. Then the Welsh sent in a carpenter known to the people in the castle. He goes up, "Oh, g'day, fellas, how you going? Yeah, no, just here to just get some stuff fixed up. No worries. Yeah, no. Oh, like, oh, in you come, mate. No, all good. No, not a problem." But once the carpenter was led in through the gates, he smacked the two guards who had opened the gate over the head, and, well, presumably yelling April Fool as he did so, and then let the 40 rebels in, who quickly overpowered the remaining three guards and took control of the castle. Very neatly done. When the English sent a force of hundreds to attempt to retake the castle, they realized their position was hopeless. Even if they wanted to try the same trick that had worked on them, Good Friday wasn't for another year. And honestly, the Welsh probably wouldn't fall for it, would they? So another great big dub for the Welsh here, one that Glyndŵr himself compounded in June, when he finally fought a pitched battle against the English. The Battle of Mynydd Hedgan took place between a force of thousands of English soldiers, as many as 5,000, according to some sources, although other estimates put it as low as 1,500, against a force of Welsh soldiers that numbered at most 500 and perhaps as little as 120 men. So outnumbered by approximately 10 to 1, the Welsh somehow managed to beat the English and the Flemish allies that they'd brought with them. And it's thought that they did this through the use of mobility. The Welsh had archers mounted on little ponies that were able to zip about here and there and help them harry the English, while the English force was not only poorly organized, not only lacking in discipline and experience, but also slowed down by the marshy and boggy terrain. The heavily encumbered English troops, who just gave up after about 200 of their number were killed, were roundly defeated by the Welsh, and Glyndŵr took a great many English soldiers prisoner as well, while the rest fled back across the border once again. Yet another big win for the Welsh here.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
So now the English had to respond, and let me tell you, respond they bloody well did. After this string of embarrassing defeats at the hands of the Welsh rebels, in 1401 and 1402, the English Parliament passed a series of laws that have become known as the Penal Laws against the Welsh. And these laws were not just openly discriminatory against the Welsh, but harshly oppressive of the entire nation. These laws banned Welsh people from holding high political offices, from buying English land, from carrying weapons, even from just gathering together in public. English people were allowed to arrest Welsh people that they considered to be in their debt and confiscate their property. If a Welsh person was accused of a crime and fled from England into Wales, they could just be executed more or less summarily. And this is just the start. There were a whole host of other laws put in place between 1401 and 1402, specifically designed not just to crack down on rebellious Welsh people, but also to make life hard generally for all Welsh people everywhere. These penal laws were very transparently reprisals for Glyndŵr's rebellion, and the intent was perhaps to make ordinary people in Wales abandon the rebellion because the oppression they were suffering at the hands of the English just made life too difficult. It made them want to give up. However, these penal laws did not have this effect. Rather than squeeze the life out of the rebels and their sympathisers, this mistreatment at the hands of the English only hardened Welsh resolve against their oppressors. More and more people took up arms in support of Glyndŵr, who, in early 1402, copped another massive dub when he ambushed and captured his hated neighbour, Baron Grey. Glyndŵr was then able to ransom Grey to King Henry for a sizable sum. Not a king's ransom, certainly, but hey, no one's turning down a baron's ransom. But then, another win came along for Glyndŵr in mid-1402. And this one's pretty funny, right? Check this out. So Henry continued to send more English troops into Wales to try to fight the rebels there. And they were led by various English commanders, one of whom was a bloke named Sir Edward Mortimer. Now, Mortimer was unlucky enough to run into Glyndŵr, who promptly wiped the floor with his army and took him prisoner. This time, however, when Henry received another ransom demand for another captured English noble, he refused to pay. He would not pay Glyndŵr's demanded ransom, principally because Glyndŵr had actually done Henry a favour by taking Mortimer out of action. Why? Because, remember, Henry is only new to the English throne. He only took it from Richard II a couple of years beforehand. His rule is by no means secure, and it just so happened that Mortimer himself had a claim to the English throne, perhaps a claim that was even better than the one that Henry had. So Henry was actually quite happy for Mortimer to languish in a Welsh prison. He was no longer a threat to Henry's reign, except he very much was, because when Glyndŵr found out that Henry wasn't going to pay the ransom, he released Mortimer from prison, he married him to one of his daughters, and negotiated an alliance with him against the English king. An outstanding move, and Mortimer wasn't the only English lord to switch sides and fight against Henry rather than fight for him, because in 1403, another prominent English noble family, the Percys, related to Mortimer by marriage, also turned their coats and rose in rebellion against Henry, who by now really is having a terrible time, particularly because in addition to these mutinous barons, the Welsh Revolt had, by 1403, spread across the entire nation of Wales. A fire had been lit in the hearts of Welsh people everywhere, not just in Wales too. Welsh people living across the border in England, Welsh workers who had left Wales to seek work, Welsh students studying in English universities, they all stopped what they were doing and they returned home to join Glyndŵr and his fight against the English. And what a fight it was. Glyndŵr marched across Wales, attacking English castles and burning English-dominated towns and estates to the ground if they refused to surrender. The English did attempt to give as good as they got. They burnt towns in Glyndŵr's homelands in the northeast of Wales. But things got even worse for the English when the French joined the war in support of the Welsh. Remember, the Hundred Years' War is still going, sort of. It's kind of like three-quarter time at this point. They're having a bit of a break. But there was no reason for the French not to help give the English a hiding by proxy. And so they threw their lot in behind the Welsh and aided them in attacking English castles. By 1404, Owain Glyndŵr's rebellion had gone so well, the English had had their pants so thoroughly pulled down, Henry IV was in such a bad position that Glyndŵr decided the time had come to make his rule over Wales official. He had the support of Welsh people up and down the country. He had the backing of the French. He'd beaten the English at more or less every turn. And so now the time had come, he deemed, for him to be officially confirmed as the Prince of Wales. Glyndŵr called a cynulliad, a gathering, sort of like a parliament, really, in the town of Machynlleth, where he was crowned as prince, and then held his royal court in Harlech, governing, for all intents and purposes, like a proper prince, with a proper government, and the proper widespread support of the people he now claimed to rule. To strengthen his position, the next year he negotiated an agreement known as the Tripartite Indenture with Mortimer, the bloke from before, and another fella named Henry Percy, a member of one of the English families who had gone up against Henry. I mentioned them as well. Under the Tripartite Indenture, these three men would, after Henry was utterly defeated, split England and Wales between the three of them. Glyndŵr would get Wales, obviously, of course he would, and also just a little bit extra of England, you know, as a little treat, while Mortimer would get the south of England and Percy would get the north. Now, without wanting to spoil things too much here, you only have to look at a map of England and Wales these days to see that these nations did not get divvied up in this fashion, so obviously the Tripartite Indenture failed. But still, just think of the enormous ambition of these men, the position that they were in 1405, committed to the idea of this radical change to the political makeup of the British Isles. Glyndŵr also sought allies abroad as well to strengthen his position. Not only did he do everything he could to keep the French on side, he also made overtures to the Irish and also to the Scottish, both of whom obviously weren't fans of the English, asking them to aid the Welsh in their quest for true and lasting independence. He didn't make too much headway with the Irish, but the Scots seemed happy enough to support the Welsh, and the French even signed a treaty with Glyndŵr as well. So, buoyed by these successes, firing on all cylinders here, Glyndŵr began to enact a new government program, putting forth his ideas for an independent Welsh Parliament, an independent Welsh church, Welsh universities, and a shift back towards traditional Welsh law. However, I am sorry to say that we are finally reaching a tipping point in the story of Owain Glyndŵr, because in 1406, the winds began to change. Firstly, the French withdrew their support for the Welsh, as the hawkish French lords who had supported a treaty and alliance with the enemy of their enemy were supplanted by French lords instead seeking a lasting peace with the English. And secondly, the English took an all-new approach to fighting the Welsh and undermining their new prince, and this approach was a lot more effective. King Henry IV was still sending troops in to fight Glyndŵr and his forces, and they had a bit more luck than they had had in the past, but the biggest driver of change when it came to the English fortunes in the war against the Welsh was the fact that Henry's son, also named Henry, the future Henry V, known at that point as Henry of Monmouth, he was known as Henry of Monmouth because he was actually born in Monmouth, which, as it happens, is in Wales. This bloke was Welsh by birth, and all the same began to take control of the campaign against Glyndŵr and the Welsh. But yes, from 1406 onwards, it was Henry of Monmouth that led the campaign against the Welsh rebels, and this campaign was in stark contrast to the one that had been led by his father. Henry IV had been all about reprisals and punishment, attempting to put down the rebellion through force, crushing the life out of it with military might. But young Henry of Monmouth, however, he took a different and a much more effective approach than his old man had. He instead moved to destroy the Welsh, not militarily, but economically. And this worked. It bloody well worked, let me tell you, as the English, on Henry of Monmouth's orders, blockaded Wales. The English had held on to some key Welsh castles despite Glyndŵr's successes. Again, it's very difficult to take a castle by force. And these were used to control the flow of goods and supplies and, critically, weapons into Wales. And this was a lot more effective than attempting to fight the Welsh head on. Their economy had been so integrated with that of England's that once they were cut off from the English economically, Wales essentially just began to fall apart. And at the same time, Henry of Monmouth also offered the chance for any rebellious Welsh lords to come back to the fold, paying a fine for their misdeeds against the English and having the slate wiped clean. It had worked before to a lesser extent, and this time around, oh boy. With no access to goods or supplies, with trade coming to a standstill, with the Welsh economy collapsing, many Welsh lords turned away from their Prince Glyndŵr and renewed their former loyalties to the English crown. And all the while, English troops were sent out from their castles to retake land bit by bit. Throughout 1407 and into 1408, Henry of Monmouth masterfully, really, you have to admit, retook much of Wales with minimal bloodshed, just offering the Welsh the right set of incentives to give up on their rebellion. Glyndŵr's revolt had been exceptionally well-timed. It had caught the English unprepared at a time of political crisis, but the long and the short of it is that the English were stronger and wealthier than the Welsh, and once they'd had a chance to deal with their crises and consolidate their position, the English were able to steamroll the Welsh into submission. And the ambitious young Henry of Monmouth in particular, he demonstrated his skills as a leader in turning the tide of the war against Wales, foreshadowing his enormous future successes as the King of England, as Henry V. With the wind out of the sails of the Welsh Revolt, with Wales being reclaimed by English forces piece, by 1409, Glyndŵr had, unbelievably, next to nothing left. Harlech, his capital, fell that year and he was forced to flee. His ally Percy had abandoned him, Mortimer was killed, half his family had been taken prisoner by the English, and things were going from bad to worse for poor Glyndŵr, especially when he sent off desperate messages to the French and the Scottish, begging them to come to his aid, and these messages were ignored by his former allies. Abandoned by all but his most loyal followers, in 1410, Glyndŵr staged one last huge raid against the English, marching into England itself and attacking Shropshire, and this was a total disaster. The English roundly defeated the Welsh, they took many of the Welsh commanders prisoner and later executed them, and while Glyndŵr escaped, he by now had lost everything. His lands were retaken by the English, and he lived life on the run, an outlaw prince for the following years. And then, in 1413, Henry IV died, and when Henry of Monmouth took the throne as Henry V, he sought to end the Welsh revolt once and for all with reconciliation, interestingly. Once again, he offered pardons to any remaining mutinous Welsh barons. He restored their lands and titles to them after extracting fines from them, because Henry V wanted the Welsh revolt over and done with, because he had bigger fish to fry. In 1415, he invaded France. He won the legendary Battle of Agincourt, and he kicked off the final stage of the Hundred Years' War. And so to fully focus on the war with France, Henry V wanted the situation in Wales fully wrapped up. And so, most interestingly of all, the offer of a pardon was actually extended to Owain Glyndŵr himself, should he come out of hiding and give himself up. But he never did. The last time Glyndŵr was ever seen by the English was in 1412, leading one final raid against the English in Wales. But after that, he disappeared. And while enormous rewards were offered for his capture, he was never again seen by the English. We don't know, not for sure, what happened to him. It's very likely that he went into hiding and lived out the rest of his days, supported by old friends and allies who were loyal enough to never betray him to the English, even with the promise of great riches in the rewards that had been posted for this outlaw prince. And so he remained free and at large, but his rebellion had failed, and his vision for an independent and autonomous Wales had been dashed to pieces. Owain Glyndŵr's death is said to have taken place in 1415, when he was around 60 years of age, and to this day, we don't know where he was buried, although a great many people have a great many theories on the matter. Wales suffered mightily in the wake of Glyndŵr's rebellion. Despite the conciliatory attitude of Henry V, that didn't stop the English Parliament from passing and then enforcing more penal laws against Wales than ever, and that was just the start of it. The economic damage done by Henry of Monmouth's blockades was felt for generations. It was compounded by the fact that most Welsh noblemen were also impoverished by the fines that they'd had to pay Henry upon accepting their pardons. Wales wasn't all that wealthy before the revolt, and it was much worse off afterwards. Widespread discrimination against the Welsh as second-class citizens, continued economic oppression at the hands of the English, and then, in the 16th century, the full-scale annexation of Wales by England. Owain Glyndŵr never managed to fulfil his dream of an independent Wales, but his name lives on as one of the great heroes of that nation. He is, to this very day, a symbol of Welsh nationalism, an icon to those who still seek an independent and autonomous Wales, free from the autonomy of Westminster. Although I probably should say that this is not a vision held by all that many in Wales these days. Recent opinion polls put Welsh support for an independent Wales at just 18%. In any case, the future of Wales, either as an ongoing part of the UK or as its own independent nation, remains to be seen. But heroes like Owain Glyndŵr live on in Welsh memory, celebrated by a nation that is, sadly, readily overshadowed and forgotten about due to its powerful neighbour to the east. But that's it. That's all she wrote today, sports fans. That is the story of Owain Glyndŵr and the rebellion that he led unsuccessfully against the English. And I do hope you enjoyed it, particularly any Welsh listeners out there. I hope I did your proud nation justice with this slice of Welsh history. I think we'll do a little bit more Welsh history next week in Quarter Hour History, so keep your eyes out for that. But beyond that, I'm also looking forward to the next full-length episode of Half Hour History. Looking forward to putting this one together for you because it's a topic that many, many people have requested. It's a topic that is obviously going to be very appropriate at this time of year because next week we will be getting across the Gallipoli campaign. With Anzac Day coming up, I thought it was an appropriate time to have a chat about a pivotal chapter in the histories of both Australia and Aotearoa New Zealand. So if you're a fan of World War One history, if you want to know more about the Gallipoli campaign and the Aussie and Kiwi involvement in that conflict, be sure to come back next week and get across that. Looking forward to your company then. But now it's time for all the boring housekeeping stuff as usual. Kicking things off, of course, by thanking everyone who's got in touch. Got a lot of emails this week, and I appreciate some of the very candid feedback I've been getting from listeners. It's not always easy to read critical emails, but I do appreciate them. A friend of mine, Serge, once pointed out that when a listener or someone who's consuming the content you make, when they take the trouble to get in touch with you to tell you that you've stuffed something up and that you've got something wrong or that they don't like something, it means that they care. They care enough to tell you rather than just walking away. And so I do very sincerely appreciate everyone who's got in touch with feedback, whether it's positive or negative. As long as it's constructive and well meant, then I do want to thank everyone who has written in, not just with feedback, but of course with topic suggestions. And I also want to thank people who are availing themselves of the new merch store over at the Print Bar. You can follow the link in the episode description or at halfhousehistory.net, of course. And I want to remind people that I'm probably going to be closing up the TeePublic merch store in the coming weeks. So make sure to get across that. If there are any products you want to buy on that shop, be sure to do it sooner rather than later because that shop's going to close pretty quick. Anyway, that's enough of that. It is time to come to what is now increasingly my favorite part of these increasingly lengthy outros. It's time for social media chat, everyone. Last week, with the Extinction of the Dodo episode, again, recorded ahead of time, I thought, I'll be able to thank some of the people who have been commenting. It's very funny to see that a couple of people here and there have been commenting on all the stuff that I've been putting up on TikTok and Instagram. Give this man a book deal. Hoo boy! A couple of people, I thought. Every single post I have made has been inundated with all these glorious listeners going and posting some variation on the theme of give this man a book deal. It is honestly so funny. And I've had people that I work with, like people from Acast and others who are involved in the show, to talking about, it really seems like people are keen for the book. That's a good sign. So it's working. If I can trick people who, are closely associated with the show, we'll have no trouble pulling the wool over the publisher's eyes. Absolutely keep doing this. It is so funny to see how many people are coming up with all these incredibly creative ways to demand a book deal of various publishers, also tagging publishers as well. I don't know if that works or not, but hey, can't hurt. So thank you so very, very much. I'm so sorry that I'm not going to sit here and name every single person who's been doing this because we would just be here for like an hour. Every post I put up has 50 or more comments from people demanding a book deal. However, in what is really emerging as a regular feature now as part of these outros, it's time for my favorite comment of the week, because I do go through and read every single comment. I'm deeply appreciative of all of them. Obviously, of course, I go through and read them all. Who doesn't like having their ego massaged in that way? Although, then again, some of the comments that some listeners are making are anything but boosts to the ego. There are some commenters who are really letting me have it, and one such commenter was Golf and Joel, who felt the need felt the need to comment. The moustache is throwing a lot of people, it seems. Had a couple of comments from people saying that they expected me with a full-on Herodotus-like beard. Well, I wouldn't be able to grow one even if I wanted to, but I do have a little moustache. And Golf and Joel had the following remark to make about my choice of facial hair. Golf and Joel said, "The moustache is incredible." Well, thank you very much, Golf and Joel. "It looks like a rat looking over a piece of rope." Very evocative. Really, just the imagery there is it's poetic almost, I would say. So thank you very much, Golf and Joel, for the comment of the week this week. Really just put me in my place with my my choice of facial adornment there. Anyway, Golf and Joel isn't the only listener I want to shout out this week. I do want to thank all the people that are posting variations on the theme of Give This Man a Book Deal. I still just find it so funny. But I also want to thank the people who have jumped over to patreon.com/halfasshistory and are supporting the show, putting their money where their mouth is, and coughing up each and every month, supporting the show financially. And there's been a huge crop of new patrons, all of whom will now gain access to all sorts of behind-the-scenes stuff, uncut episodes, show notes, early access to episodes as well, in addition to exclusive merch and ad-free listening. You'll love to hear it. These listeners are Aaron Julius, thanks Aaron, Crystal Kearney, Ben Chambers, Cassius Gentle, Max Burr, Henry Gross, Boris Shishkov, good on you, Boz, Max Lusterhand, and then subscribing at the highest tier, people truly of great taste and refinement, S and Anthony Blessing. So thank you so very much to Aaron, Crystal, Ben, Cassius, Max, Henry, Boris, Max, S, and Anthony. Good on the lot of you. And if you want to join this exalted company, you can do so, of course, for as little as $5 a month and gain access to all of the stuff that I talked about and indeed that exclusive merch. So thank you very much to all the patrons, new and old, supporting me, and to all the listeners, new and old as well, spreading the word of Half-Ass History, telling their friends, telling their enemies, telling people about whom they feel largely ambivalent. It is deeply, deeply appreciated. Thank you very much for supporting the show in whatever way you do. Anyway, that's enough of me going on and on. Looking forward to another week of, well, I was going to say nonsense. It's not nonsense next week. It's actually quite a serious and weighty topic, so a little bit less nonsense next week, but I do hope you'll join me all the same. Make sure to head over to TikTok, Instagram, Twitter. It's just Half-Ass History at all of those platforms, except on Twitter, or X, sorry, where it's Half-Ass Histore without a Y. Wouldn't fit. Very annoying. And be sure to leave comments along the theme of Give This Man a Book Deal, or try to one-up Golf and Joel with the next rude comment about my appearance. I'm looking forward to reading them. But until then, of course, leaving you with a question posed on Reddit. This one comes to us from Special K60. I wasn't able to find an amusing question about whales. So instead, I'm now going to read you an amusing question about whales instead. Special K60 wants to know, how do sperm whales reproduce if there are no egg whales?
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.